Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for June 6, 2024, in the time warp world we live in. This year is just flying by. I just don't know what's going on. We're almost to June 21st, which is the longest day of the year. And, of course, after that, the days start getting shorter, reminding us that we live in a cold climate for most of the people. At any rate, I want to start talking about, there's a woman here. Now, this many people sent me. The name of this woman is Sabine Hossenfeld, and she's got appears to be an Austrian accent or something like that. And the name of this video is My Dream Died and Now I'm Here. She has a YouTube channel and 2.5 million views, so this has gotten some traction. And of course, people sent it in, sent to me, because this woman's dream was to become a physicist. Now, I was going to try and play this, but I don't really have a way to get her voice on here. But she spends about 13 minutes describing her history of going from just a very enthusiastic young student in a physics program to getting her master's degree, then looking for employment in the graduate school, for which she did get like a woman-only scholarship of some kind, and kept being put off because this was in the early 1990s. But at any rate, I should mention that I got my bachelor's degree in 1970 and got my master's degree. I took a few years off. I went and explored the world, and then I came back and I got my master's degree at Tulane in 1975, and then went off to explore the world again. That's where I went to foreign countries and earned my title as professor as a young person, etc. But at any rate, getting back to this woman, she had experiences that she said she thought that, you know, she was amongst intelligent people. And then she realized how the system worked, that you got grants, or the professors got grants to study things that were designated from on high. There was a grant book, and I've seen the grant books. They're about as big as an old-fashioned small-town telephone book, probably maybe an inch thick. And I've seen the professors grab the book and look through it, page through it. Can we do this? Can we do this? Can we match the qualifications for this grant? And that's when I was at Tulane. I worked on a research assistantship, that was called. There are a few different types of support when you go to university level. There's the fellowship, which is just you get paid to study, and they all pay pretty dismally, but it's enough to live on as a student. And I had a research assistantship, which meant they paid me a stipend per month for my living expenses. And then they paid all of my tuition and books and everything else. So I had no expenses for my education part of it. And then there's were other people that had teaching assistantships, and they taught a class for their, basically for their, to earn their stipend. Okay, so at any rate, this woman is gets this scholarship, and then she's very excited, eventually goes in and gets some work in universities, and then starts working on programs basically for other people, and then realizes, in her words, it is all bullshit. And that's true, because it is. The way science works in the United States, it's all complete BS. The universities live off of this funding, and so the bigger the university, the more money they get. Sometimes as much as 50% of the grant money just goes right into the coffers. And of course, that pays for the salary. My particular professor at Tulane was in the grant he got that I was working on was a very good one. was issued by the National Institute of Health, and he had a boatload of projects coming in. He was almost daily finding new grants, new money, etc. And some of it very good. The project I worked on was polyvinyl carbonate. It was a synthetic material that we made in the laboratory. That was one of my things I did. And I worked with people from Gulf South Research, which was the at the time the, building up as a lot of chemists working there. And so my project was to look at these as charge transfer complexes, something very similar to solar panels. That'd be the closest thing you might notice that would be similar to what I was working on. But at any rate, there's a lot of legitimate science and engineering that goes on. But at the university level, most of it is complying, doing some kind of research related to these catalogs of that are put together by scientists who've climbed the ladder till they're finally hired into some kind of government position. They sit on boards. Sometimes they don't belong to the government. They belong to the universities, but they try and think of where science should go, and then they create these catalogs of research, and then that's a mechanism for distributing the grant money that, say, the NSF, the National Science Foundation, or the National Institute of Health, etc. They want you, the professors out there, to study these. Okay, so at any rate, this woman eventually understands that the entire process is complete baloney. And all of this research that's going on in the publications and this whole cycle of research grant publication, publish or perish, is all a complete farce. And she's mixed in it. She finally quits. And so the people are sending me this video because they know my story. And of course, I didn't quit. I got quit. And because I was doing actual real research using actual data that came from NASA space probes and discovering things that literally flew in the face of NASA and when I was at Cornell, I'm talking about, of course, the Cornell was a Library of Congress for one thing. So it was literally had all the books that were ever published, going back to the Gutenberg Bible in the stacks. And also they were the stronghold for NASA. NASA had a very large presence at Cornell. So all the data that came from any of the space probes or anything NASA related was at Cornell, and they had many, many space scientists and astronomers and other people who literally worked for NASA but resident at Cornell. So I was like, elbow to elbow with these people when I was in the physics and the math department because I was up there all the time after class every day. Literally, there were sometimes two or three data sessions up in the big auditorium. And they had a big screen TV where they would project the data and talk about it. And then sometimes 50 scientists there, sometimes 10, sometimes 3. And all this data coming in, and I'd sit there and watch it, and I realized that these guys had no clue at all of what they were doing. And it was like there were some real arrogant ones there that were just mouthy. And everybody just kind of kowtowed to them because most astrophysicists and those types are pretty mealy-mouse little people. They're not aggressive. They're not alpha males, to put it lightly. And so I was there watching this data come in, and so they would project these concepts. Oh, look at this, and they would say, well, maybe that's due to such and such. And then that would become published in, say, the science articles or the Nature articles that came out of this. And then that would become standard fare, and that would be eventually repeated in textbooks. And I saw firsthand the garbage science being produced. And what I realized is that I realized what was going on because I had all my theoretical work done by the time I got to Cornell, including magnetic and electric fields in celestial mechanics. And so I realized what was going on and what the data said. And the redshifts data, all kinds of stuff. But at any rate, this woman finally got to the point where she recognized it was complete baloney and just stopped. She said she didn't want to spend her life doing this. But like I say, many people sent me this video because I could relate to it, or they could relate to the story that I gave regarding this, my experiences in the scientific world. But make no mistake, there were studies done recently of all the major universities. So you got the big cluster up in the Northeast, the Ivy League schools, and the ones down the East Coast. And then you have the West Coast big schools, mainly concentrated around Southern California, La Jolla, and those schools, which are big science schools. Some of them are CIA prep schools, where they develop scientists and other people under their wing, because, you know, and that's related to JPL, Gulf South Research. It was, you know, when I was there, it was called Gulf South because it was literally in the New Orleans area where I was at Tulane. And of course, has expanded into this mammoth research facility now that does all kinds of government, private government work. Okay, but at any rate, yeah, so this lady realized that this was complete BS and then ends up with a YouTube channel, and she has millions of followers. She had like 2.5 million views or whatever on this little 13-minute video. So it's an interesting platform, but unfortunately mixed with an absolute ocean of garbage. But it's a venue that people can partake in. Okay, well, in a little while I'll have an update on the Boeing Starliner. That's the spacecraft, the rocket, relative to Boeing, to take astronauts to the space station, and that'll be their first manned launch. Anyway, I'll have a comment on that shortly. First, I want to talk, however, about the NASA X-34 spaceplane program that happened many, many decades ago. It was a failure for many, many reasons, but basically it was an unmanned mini shuttle type of a craft. And I want to compare it to a Russian craft called the Cosmos with a K. K-O-S-M-O-S was the Russian mini space shuttle, and that was a manned version. It was a three-man mini space shuttle. And they could go up, and they had so much lift capability in the 1960s that they could put this on top of their rockets, because they had these heavy lift rockets, kerosene rockets, that they had out in the steppes of Russia, where they put their launch facilities out away from anything. And they had a system, and they're still using the same rockets today. They will launch two or three per day. They have an immensely busy space program, and the United States, for a long time, including now, is still using Russian launch facilities to get even classified military payloads into space. But the Russian version of the Cosmos, of the mini space shuttle, like I say, was a three-man. And I have some pictures of it on my webpage. There's some... I talked about this in one of my talks, one of my videos. I talk about it at the, where was that? The UFO Congress, where I had slides when I was giving my talks there. I gave two, it was a 2002, 2003, or 2003, 2004, one of those in Laughlin, Nevada. And I was talking about the space programs. But anyway, back to the X-34's program, it was mainly due to cost overruns and technical issues that it was finally scrapped. But then there was another version called the 37B. The X-37B was also an unmanned mini space shuttle, and eventually went the same route. Now, the idea was that there was a a commercial airplane. It was a Lockheed. This was back in the day when Lockheed was making commercial airliners, and it was called the Stargazer. And so it was a commercial airliner, basically fit with a this rocket plane, so to speak, under the belly, not under the wing, but under the belly of the aircraft. Would take it up to probably 35, 40,000 feet and then release it. And of course, the NASA and all of the other industry went with vertical lift, heavy lift rockets. And they never got past this small rocket stage. And of course, that's what Richard Branson was doing. And I think that he had some failures and he folded that end of his business. But eventually, the issue was, and this is one of my, I don't know if it's a criticism, it's just an observation, that nobody ever really got big with that, with the runway to launch, runway to orbit, as it's called, space programs. And that's really the best way to go. And the Starliner, which I'll be commenting on here in a minute, had a successful first stage burn this morning to get into orbit. But the majority of that fuel is burnt up, getting up to relatively minor altitudes. And it's a very slow ascent because of the high wind resistance of the atmosphere. But you can do the same thing and lift the same payload with a craft like, say, a 747 jet airliner, or modify it. And this is something I've shown on my webpage, is a system that I call the hotel launch system, where you actually design an airplane that its entire fuselage is the payload. It's somewhat like a rocket launcher, a shoulder-held rocket launcher with wings on it. Okay, so anyway, just a commentary on that, and we'll see where these technologies go. But the big companies all continue to go with large-scale, heavy-lift rockets. And okay, next topic, I want to talk about the definition of a virus. In the world of astrophysics, it's gotten really kind of insane with the if you go to, in fact, I did this in a couple different subject areas recently. I went to the literature, the peer-reviewed literature, both in cosmology and in mathematics. And it is out there so far in Never Never Land that it's just actually incredible. People working on esoteric little topics that, and especially when it comes to cosmology, that have absolutely nothing to do with reality. It's not based on experiment anymore. It's based on what people calculate or people think that they, dark matter, dark energy, something that nobody's ever seen or measured. And they're talking about all of these different calculations and some people's different viewer that energy becomes weak over distance, and that light loses its energy or it becomes redshifted. All of these different things that have never ever been verified in any way, shape, or form by experimentation. And this is what has happened in the world of virology, where they're talking about viruses and the issue is when now I received a paper the other day, and finally people are getting to the point where they're re-examining how the COVID virus was defined, and it turns out that it was a series of computer animations, basically, and excuse me, the process of defining this virus, basically they took cell material from human blood, if that was even human blood, we are not sure, but they grind it up into little pieces, And then they examine those pieces to see what their construction is. And then they, with a computer, they rebuild these pieces into what they consider to be a virus. And the problem is it is not reproducible. This is the whole issue, that if you take the same data and the same software running on the exact same computer, you do not get the same result. In other words, it's not reproducible. And it's one of the biggest things. If you also look at, say, cosmology, the same thing. People are often Never Never Land, and there's no such thing as a second independent party doing research and verifying it. It's just individual people making individual claims without any verification at all. And so this is the issue. There are what I'm going to use the terminology pathogens. And for example, say you go to Mexico and you eat the food off the street there. The people there are immune to it, but there's some bacteria that'll turn you inside out, I guarantee you. It's loosely called Montezuma's Revenge. But the people there are accustomed to it. Their bodies have developed immunity to whatever that is. And if they come up to where you live, chances are there will be bacteria there that they are not immune to, that their immune system has never seen, and that makes them sick. So, and I've seen this. I've seen people coming from other countries who get sick eating food in the United States. It's the same situation. Or take another example where when the Europeans first came to the New World, they brought chickenpox and other diseases like that that the natives in the Western Hemisphere had never seen or witnessed before, and they had no immune resistance to it at all, and they died, whereas the Europeans had a bit of native immunity to these that was carried through the population, actually from mother to baby. And so they literally developed what you call very loosely herd immunity. But there are some things that people just don't develop an immunity to. One of them is called dengue fever. It's a pathogen, it's an organism that develops in mosquitoes. And if a mosquito bites a person with dengue fever or the dengue pathogen, it develops in the mosquito for a number of days, and then if that mosquito bites another person, then that transfers to the other person, and they get dengue fever. And there's other things like that. There's a long list of those things that you can get in the tropics. There's one called Monga. It's another variation type of thing that comes from mosquitoes. So if you happen to be a white guy from North America, Canada, United States, and you go to the tropics, and you are amongst people in a tropical area where there's rainfall, then there's standing water, there's mosquito development, and dengue is present in the population, chances are you are going to get a mosquito bite and get dengue fever. These are real issues. These are real things. They're not put together by a computer simulation. And so let me once again repeat the concept here. The difficulty is repeatability. The entire issue of using what is known as PCR and developing a simulated virus is that it really was never meant to do that. It was a research tool, like a lot of tools, like a hammer. And I gave an example yesterday on the radio show, and it goes as follows. Imagine you take a salad, and it's got lettuce and carrots and tomatoes and all kinds of vegetables in there. And this would be the equivalent of a blood sample. You have thousands of things in the blood. And so then you take this material and you grind it up into just zillions of little teeny teeny pieces down almost to the molecular level. Okay, then you take a computer and you remove anything that looks like it may have came from lettuce or from carrots or from tomatoes, because those are things that are known. And you take all the other pieces, and now you take a computer program and you put them together in different sequences until you finally get one that you think that this may be the odd man out or the virus. And that's where they got the virus from. Nobody ever developed a vaccine based on an actual virus. And all of the, well reported now that all of the vaccines were already developed. And so how could they be developed if somebody only defined the virus in 2020 when the COVID thing was first announced? So at any rate, the whole issue with science is, number one, it has to be repeatable, and it has to be repeatable by an independent, verifiable third party. In other words, they don't have anything. They don't have an axe to grind. They don't have money coming in from the same source. They don't have a scientific association in any way, or monetary or economic association in any way, with the original group that did the research. This was not done. And so only now, after years and, you know, billions of people getting a vaccine, that, you know, the whole thing is now coming out to be a complete fraud. And primarily the development, it was, the impression was given, and I was one that heard this too, and all of the scientists and Fauci followed the science. There was no science. And if you call that science, then you have bastardized the word science, because the number one thing that science has to do is has to be repeatable. Okay, so at any rate, very important to talk about that. And so I want to distinguish between the word pathogen, which there are, and there are things that one might be able to call a virus. But virology has gotten to the point, it's like cosmology, is often never, never land. And there's no way to bring it back. It has, you know, there's absolutely zero confidence in what they're doing, where they're, you know, basically computer modeling what they're calling viruses. It's not something in a test tube. It's not something in a petri dish. It's not something that's actually extracted from somebody and related to a disease of any kind. The biggest thing, it is not reproducible. And that's what I'm reporting on, is the article on the math and computer side of this that is not reproducible. In other words, the data set, the entire data set with the exact same procedure in the exact same sequencing by exactly the same computer system, using the same software, using the same database, does not produce something that even closely resembles what the original papers predicted. Okay, so anyway, very important. That's going to be, you still have people misquoting. They still have people trying to give shots to little kids for something that never existed. And the best thing you can say about it, that most likely it was just a flu, because automatically when COVID started, nobody got the flu anymore. Everybody ended up getting, being classified. Everything was classified as COVID. Even if you had a car accident, you were classified as dying with COVID. Okay, so enough of that, but I think it's important to make that clear, that that is starting to emerge now, and you'll see more of that. Just quickly, I have another book. Actually, there might be two books coming out here soon, and so keep an eye out for that. I currently have 14 books on my webpage, and that's something I want to announce too, is my webpage, jmccsci.com, is the short URL. is up now and operating with all of the products there. So I encourage you, you can buy the books individually now, something you could not do before. And the videos are there. Some of them are downloadable, like the What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X. That video was done probably about 10 years ago now, more or less, 10 years. The Japanese film industry got a hold of me, and they produced a television show the equivalent of 60 Minutes in Japan. And so they were looking in the United States for somebody to talk about the topic of Planet X, and they chose me, which was the best choice because there's, you know, at the time there were, you know, hundreds of, literally hundreds of quacks out there talking about 2012 and the Mayan calendar and Planet X and everything in the kitchen sink, you know, and all of these people were imposters. So they rightfully, I should say, got a hold of me and they said, we want to do an interview. And so they flew their staff over. It was coordinated out of their office in New York with a producer there, and they coordinated the entire filming staff, the producer of the show, the head producer from Japan, and they came to where I was at the time, and I had a studio. So they had a place set up, and at the last minute it didn't work out. So I said, well, come over to my studio. We'll do it there. And so they filmed this in my studio. It was like the sitting room outside of my studio, actually. So they set up their cameras, and I thought, you know, I'm going to get my DVD camera, set it up, and I recorded the whole thing. So the whole thing took 3 hours, the interview, and they had an interpreter there, a young lady, who would take the questions of the producer because he did not speak any English, and transfer them. The questions to me. So I basically sat on a chair. They turned on multiple cameras. And then I had my DVD, high definition DVD camera there, taking a video of the entire session. Like I say, lasted 3 hours. When they showed it in Japan, they cut it down to less than an hour. So it was like a 60-minute show, and I was the primary guest and talking about Planet X. And they were prepared. They had very good questions. But the point is that the entire 3-hour video that I took is available on my webpage. It's called What the Japanese Want to Know About Planet X. And that video is now downloadable on my webpage. I listened to it the other day because I'm doing archiving. I'm archiving basically 50 years of work. And so in the process, I listened to bits and pieces of it, not the full 3 hours. But the information there is so relevant today because I did such a good job of explaining what really happened. Also, I have a book. It's called The Real History of Planet X, a 2020 Update. And there's 14 books there, so I'm not going to go through listing them all. But go to the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's the short URL. My full URL is jmccanniscience.com, but most people can't get it all of the letters correct. So I have the short URL for doing radio and interviews, etc., jmccsci.com. You can get to the water filter page from there. You can get to the grow tower page from there. You can get to the wing generator page from there, etc. And so, anyway, visit that page because it's newly renovated, and a lot of work went into that. But the ordering system is there, and so make use of that. Also, my education program, this is for K-12 and university students and their parents. You know, I can't stress how important it is to educate parents today, because they're third generation of baloney being taught in schools. In fact, when I was a kid, I mean, they taught what they thought was true at the time as best they could, but it actually went downhill from there. So I have an education program that's for not only for students, but for parents. And what I encourage parents to do is first take the course themselves as they're, and it's going to take literally, if you went through that whole course, it would take you a couple of years because there's something like 189 1-hour lectures. So it's going to take you a while, plus reading the books, listening to the other CDs and DVDs and lectures. It's going to take a long time to go through all of that material, but it's going to be a royal education for people to understand how the world and universe and our solar system and everything and how the world politically works. And I'm not talking about voting for president type of politics. I'm talking about the real workings of the human race and all that is going on. You got to understand that. If you don't, some back a long time ago, people would say, well, why do you talk about things like that? It has nothing to do with science. Well, no, it has everything to do with science because a long time ago, they attacked science and mathematics to take logic and reasoning out of science and mathematics. And that's where New Math came in, No Child Left Behind, all of the education programs that really were designed to dumb down the kids. And like I say, we're now dealing with third generation parents who have no clue what's going on the planet. Okay, so switching gears a little bit, I'm going to talk about some geology science. And there is a thing called Milankovitch cycles. And there's some truth to it. There's some actual good science relative to this. But it was taken, and it's been taken on the internet to be the cause of ice ages. And what it amounts to is Earth goes through cycles in its precession. The Earth is like a top that precesses on a table or on the floor, a spinning top, and the gravitational field of the sun. But and so it varies, and then there's some other cycles that go along with the Earth and its orbit around the sun, etc. But they're not really big. They're not really big, and they can cause some fluctuations, but the biggest issue is this is not the cause of ice ages on planet Earth. And the reason is because when we see ice ages, the last one was Stark, and we still have the remnants of that. We have the mastodons buried in permafrost in Siberia with undigested semi-tropical plants in their gullets. So how did this happen? Well, the only way this could have happened if Earth had a pole shift, which it did. And so there's a tremendous amount of support now. It's growing every day, people who really understand what's going on. And this is something I talked about. I went back in the 1990s. When I was young, I lived in Mexico City, and did a lot of traveling. That's where I got my start in archaeology. And continued as I traveled to other countries like Peru and various other countries, understanding the real story of archaeology. But the mastodon, the issue with the mastodons was that they died instantly and so quickly and were standing up literally on all fours, semi-tropical animals being flash frozen and with semi-tropical plants in their throats, still undigested, because how long does it take for an animal of that size, like a bison, but 10 times bigger animal to digest, have all this this grass and flowers, etc., digested? It's a matter of minutes. So these animals were flash frozen, like instantaneously. And I probably told this story before, but one time I was at, remember these mammoths, woolly mammoths were huge compared to modern day, say, bisons. But one time I was in, I think it was in the Dakotas, out in the plains, the Western Plains, someplace, and there was a buffalo ranch. And so I went in, and they were selling, of course, the buffalo meat, so they had a butcher shop in there and a big freezer. And so I asked the butcher, I said, how long would it take if you took a whole bison, put it in your freezer, how long would it take to freeze? In the course, he was assuming the animal would be dead, and he said, oh, it would take weeks, you know, for an animal that size to freeze all the way through. And I said, no, what if the animal were alive? And he looked at me like I was crazy, and he said, you couldn't do it. You could not freeze, because it's the situation is that the mass or the volume of the animal goes up as are cubed, say they were a circle or a ball, and the surface area goes up as the square. And so the amount of heat loss through the surface of the animal gets less and less. So much bigger animals fare much better in cold climates than small animals. It's just the way it is. So the end result is that a bison, if you took a live bison and put it in a deep freeze, you know, like 30, 40 below, and they do that all the time, the bison live out on the plains, and the only thing that kills them is if they cannot get down to the grass to eat on it, because they feed on a daily basis, just like any grazing animal. Their mouth is relatively small compared to their body, so they got to eat all the time just to get enough food in their body. And of course, in the wintertime, they need more to keep just to keep warm. But other than that, just basically starving to death, if they have a decent amount of food, they're going to survive, no problem. I don't care if it's 40 or 50 below. North South Dakota can be 40 below for weeks, you know, and especially at night, it gets cold in the wintertime. And so we get back to the concept of the woolly mammoths. Flash frozen instantaneously. And my belief is that the permafrost came in so quickly in that it rained in, literally rained in water and built up this permafrost that they were standing in, and they really suffocated. That's why they died quickly. And then they froze also, but they froze very quickly. And so there was an atmospheric change. There was a lot of water that came in, and then we had an ice age, and that was considered to be the Holocene, the edge of the what is called the Holocene period, where the mammoths died off, the woolly mammoths, the mastodons, the saber-toothed tiger, the sloth, the giant sloth, and all these other animals that were big. And so the idea that they were a lot of big animals, and these are big animals compared to animals that are on the planet Earth now. These are much, much, much bigger and demanded incredible amounts of food on a daily basis. So can imagine what a bison eats on a daily basis. Imagine what a cow eats on a daily basis. But imagine what a mastodon eats on a daily basis. Well, my goodness, there's literally no place on planet Earth that would support this herds of mastodons. There's literally no place that would have that much foliage. Certainly not the Russian Siberian tundra. And so these animals are completely out of place. So there's the only explanation is a pole shift. So you have all these other factors is the point. Not only the flash freezing of these giant animals, but you have them moving in position relative to the poles. And the only way you can do this, the Earth doesn't jump up and do this by itself someday, although many scientists would try and have you believe that. But the reality is the only way this can happen is from something from outside. So the Milankovitch cycles don't answer this. So it's one of those great white hope type of things, or the abiotic oil. What is abiotic oil? It's a concept that when people finally in mass started realizing that fossil fuels, in other words, oil, carbon-based materials like coal, oil, etc., are not from fern forests or dinosaur bones, which is a totally ludicrous story, they had to come up with some other explanation. So they came up with the idea of abiotic oil, that somehow these hydrocarbons down deep in the ground form oil just magically. It doesn't happen. You can't reproduce this in a laboratory. Nobody's ever done that. But yet the idea of abiotic oil is promulgated throughout the, once again, the fake internet science world of YouTube, etc., just like the Milankovitch cycles. But the end result is that the glaciation, which has ended in my lifetime, when I was a kid, Wyoming and Montana in the western states still had big glaciers. Glacier Park, there ain't no glaciers there anymore. You know, Yellowstone Park, Yosemite, had glaciers when I was a kid. They're not there anymore. The glaciers are gone. And is it due to you driving your SUV up and down the street? No. It's from direct heating of burning fossil fuels. That's the unspoken reality of global heating. There is global heating going on, but Earth is really getting back to normal is what's going on. These glaciation periods, the ice age, was instigated by a passing comet. So two things happen when a big comet comes through the solar system that we interact with, and we go through the tail. We get this influx of water and oil and other things, nitrogen, hydrogen compounds, carbon, hydrogen compounds, oxygen, hydrogen compounds, etc. And that's an influx of material. And then we get cooling because it blocks the light from the sun. So that's very important to understand. And then the pole shift. So all of these things are happening. But like I said, the Earth does not just jump up and do this all by itself. So the cause of ice ages, there were a number of them in the last 10,000 years. So the Earth has had some encounters with some major league players. And one of them we know was Venus, the very last one during the time, what I call the Velikovsky event or the Moses event or the Venus event. They're those three different names for the same event. And the best dating, I'm not going to put a date on it but I'm just going to say this happened within the last 10,000 years. And probably much sooner than that. There's evidence that mastodons went extinct all at one time, but there's evidence that mastodons were roaming the planet Earth up to 4,000 years ago, the actual direct evidence. And so that means that this event could have been, like right now we're in 2024, just say 2,000 years. So 4,000 years would put it like maybe a couple thousand years B.C. Velikovsky puts it dating at 1500 B.C., which is, in my book, the best estimate that anybody has put out there. I don't particularly pick dates. And it drives me crazy when people write in and they say, I heard your talk on the radio show and you said 1500 B.C. something. No, I don't pick dates. I never did, never will. I think it's a big mistake to pick dates. But if somebody's going to do it, they better do their homework and they better do their research. And the only person that I'm aware of who did real research, not just flippant, read something in a textbook type of explanations, the only person that has really done real research on this is Emanuel Velikovsky. And everybody else is a charlatan and a fake, including the university professors out there who, you know, they can sit in their university chair and manage the flocks around them, because if you don't agree with them, they can get rid of you. That's the bottom line. But other than that, in the real world, not many people pay much attention to them. So they're, you know, like with the old expression, big fish in a small pond can make a lot of splashing and a lot of noise, but ain't going nowhere. Now, I was flipping through some of these internet short videos the other day, and one guy was talking about some ancient Chinese legends about the Great Flood. And they were very clear that this water came from above. They had like some characters, some mythological characters, that sent a message to somebody up in the heavens, and they opened up the floodgates and let the water in. But they're talking literally about a great flood. And so if you look at my work, I'm very specific about two major events where comets did major damage to Earth. One was the Noah's flood. The other one I was just talking about was the Moses event, or the when Moses, I call it the Moses event because Moses was coming out of Egypt with the Israelites. The Israelites, which is a group of people who now occupy Scandinavia and Ireland, parts of Ireland, my ancestors actually, and a lactose tolerant group of people who settled in the steppes of Russia, in the central Europe, and then moved northwards. I call it the Moses event because, like I say, that was the other thing you could call it is the Venus event. But the other event in history was the Noah event, the Noah's flood. And this is corroborated by 200 civilizations that lived back in those times, including the Egyptians. The Egyptian priest cults talk about it. And so there are people around today who are saying, oh, all of these catastrophes happened at one time 11,000 years ago. And they're getting corroboration from, they're claiming that some ice ball comets hit Greenland and it caused all kinds of damage around the Earth, including spraying micro diamonds. How does a ice ball hit an ice pack and create micro diamonds? You'll have to explain that one to me, folks. That doesn't make any sense at all. But that's what they're trying to pound off as some kind of nouveau science. But before 11,000 years ago, there were two very big Earth-wide mass extinctions, one being the Noah's flood. And the reality there was we passed through the tail of a comet, and it lasted probably about, they say 40 days, 40 nights. So 40 is the number they use in ancient times. Like today, we use billions, like Carl Sagan would say, billions and billions. Well, that's a big number. That doesn't literally mean billion. It means so many you can't count them. Well, the biblical term for that same concept was 40. 40 days and 40 nights of rain, 40 days and 40 nights Christ went into the desert, 40 days and 40 nights. You see 40 come up quite a bit in the Bible and in ancient texts because that was the biggest number they could imagine. You know, people couldn't count very high back then. You've got 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's 20. You double that, you get to 40, and that's about as far as they could get in counting. And it was, you know, you got to give them credit. That's better than, pretty good for the time they were living in. Although the Mayan could count, they had a very extensive number counting system, etc. Cycles, understanding cycles of lunar calendars, etc. But the other mass extinction, like I said, was the Noah's event. And prior to that, the Earth was populated probably more than it is today. And they were using resources. The story that comes down to us is that they were using the Earth's resources, and these would have been surface type of resources, wood, trees, you know, overgrazing, you know, agriculture, whatever they were doing, was not as probably not mechanized as it is today. But if you imagine, say, another 3 billion people on planet Earth, go up to 10 billion, and everybody working at local agriculture, etc., and then just depleting the land, and also the various other things that would go with it, the inability to deal with human waste, and, you know, just living in kind of really rough conditions on planet Earth. And then all of a sudden, the Great Flood hits and just washes everything away. And I've talked about this before, where look at the example I used. I talked about this a week or two ago. The Titanic, this massive, big, beautiful ship that goes down at the bottom of the ocean 100 years ago, and it's on the bottom of the ocean. It's, right now, it's falling apart. And in 1,000 years, there'll be very little left that's recognizable. in 6,000 years, there won't be anything left that's recognizable at all, that a big ship was there. And so the other thing that happened during the Great Flood is the ocean levels changed. So all of the big population centers are off in the continental shelves, off towards the edge where they drop off. And so there's nothing, there's really no record of the human populations, billions of people living on planet Earth at that time. Okay, so anyway, I wanted to get in a little bit of discussion here on ice ages and climate changes. The other interesting thing about this Chinese legend was that they said the same thing as Noah, that prior to that, there was no rainbow. That's one of the very interesting things that is common in all of these legends about the Great Flood, is that prior to that, nobody had ever seen a rainbow. And after the Great Flood, God put the rainbow in the heavens to tell you that the flood had ended. And of course, they were hopeful that God would never do that again, never destroy the earth by water again. And of course, not understanding that this is part of a natural process in the solar system of big comets coming through the solar system. Not every big comet is going to cause an ice age or affect Earth directly. It's a rare, rare event. But why did Noah understand that this was coming? Because he got tipped off the information that this comet was coming. That's why he built the ark. He had notification, let's just put it that way. Okay, I just have about a minute left here. And so I want to remind you of my web pages. There's a $350 off on the best deal. That's the MR5 Whole House Water Filter. And the webpage, jmccwaterfilters.com. I also have my replacement filter, Elements for Gravity, a beautiful stainless steel sink filter that you can purchase, and then also purchase extra filter elements. But the MR5 is the flagship product, JMCC Water Filters, my company, 24 years old and still moving, still out there. And then also remember to visit my webpage, the traditional J. McCanny Science webpage. The short URL, once again, is jmccsci.com. And go there, check it out, this new webpage. There's still a few things we're going to tweak on there. But a lot of work went into that. And order some of the products. And especially the education package. That's there for students. And like I say, educating the parents. If grandparents, buy it for your grandchildren and your kids. So that and then go through this education program so you learn what's going on. And I'm out of time. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.